I'm David Sedaris from the United States, and I travel with Rick Steves.
Wait.
Je voyage. Right, would I say je voyage souvent, de temps en temps, je voyage avec Rick Steves.
Wow, you've picked up that French very well.
De temps en temps, pas toujours, mais de temps en temps, je voyage avec mon ami Rick Steves.
You got to sound like Maurice Chevalier or something, and it's actually good, or Inspector Clouseau.
Well, so many Americans, too. You know, like I've got a friend in Paris, probably the least self-conscious person I know. In El parle français comme ça.
Yeah.
And when you go to a restaurant, excusez-moi, mais j'ai commandé la salade niçoise sans la tone. Oh.
It's the world's largest and busiest, and arguably its greatest art museum, but it can be overwhelming. James Gardner examines what the grounds and buildings of the Louvre can show us about the history of Paris in his book, The Louvre: The Many Lives of the World's Most Famous Museum. James explores the site's origins as a quarry and vineyard, a 12th century fortress, a 14th century royal palace, and even the controversial glass pyramid entrance that Impey added to its courtyard. He joins us now to point out details of the imposing museum that many visitors to Paris might overlook. Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this is so important to look at the Louvre as something more than a collection of great paintings. And I've got a powerful memory, along with all the great art, of exploring some corner of this massive building and coming upon a huge turret of medieval bricks far below street level. And it reminded me, this thing's got a lot of history. And that's what your book's all about, isn't it?
That's right. The history of the Louvre, of the site that is now the Louvre, goes back thousands of years, but there has been something built on that site for the past 800 years, and what we see above ground today goes back 500 years. The thing you're referring to is the remains of a medieval castle, and before that a medieval fortress from around 1200, which lay hidden underneath the pavement of the main courtyard of the Louvre for hundreds of years after it was finally obliterated by Louis XIV. And it would be another 200 years before it was rediscovered in the 1860s. And then they covered it up again. And it was only with the creation of the Grand Louvre, starting in 1989, that it was open to the public.
Okay.
And if you go there now, you see something that for centuries people only suspected was there, but now anyone who wants can go to see it.
Right. Now, when we tourists go there to see our favorite pieces of art, we're stepping into a building that I believe in its day was the biggest building in the world. It's a building that has been built through king after king after emperor. And when you explore it, when you drive around it, I remember you see the insignia, or the initials of the various kings who ruled at the time that wing was added. What can we learn just by driving around the building?
Well, you'll notice that, as you say, it's extremely large. From one end to the other, it's about half a mile in length. As far as I know, if not the largest, longest building in the world, certainly one of the top two or three.
Yeah.
It was originally not longer, but bigger, because there was a palace at the western end of it called the Tuileries Palace, which these communards burned to the ground in 1871. But for that, it would be even bigger. And it's because of that that now you have this great prospect. When you look from the pyramid all the way to the west, you see the Arc de Triomphe, and behind that, the Arc de la Défense, a vista of 6 miles.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I've always been fascinated by this. It's called something like the Grand Perspective or something like that. That's not just accidental. I mean, you can read a lot of history into that axis, can't you?
In a way, it is accidental in the sense that if all had gone to plan, as I said, the Tuileries Palace would have been in the way, so you wouldn't have seen that great. Yeah. So it seems so perfect that everyone imagines that there was some great planning behind it.
Oh, that's funny.
But for that reason, it was decided to double the extent of it in the 1980s with the Grande Arche de la Défense.
Right.
So it is one of the grand perspectives And of Paris.
To me, it sort of illustrates the sweep of history. You got the old regime in this former royal palace, and then you go up to the place where the guillotine, you know, physically cut off the head of the old regime.
That's right.
And then you got the People's Boulevard up to the arch that was to celebrate,
which is Napoleon,
Napoleon, and then nationalism. And then beyond that, the Arc de la Défense, which is probably the part of this where most of our listeners might not know, that's the modern arch that's so big you could stick the Arc de Triomphe under it. And that's just a sort of a celebration of the modern global economy to me. So you've got this amazing expanse, and it's kind of part of the city planning of Paris, if even accidental.
That's right.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with James Gardner, and his book is The Louvre, The Many Lives of the World's Most Famous Museum. Let's go back to the palace here. When we're thinking about the palace, one of my favorite things is to look at the colonnade, which reminds me this is a grand palace from the 1600s. But then when you go into the museum, there's actually a room that has a plaque in it that says the museum was open to the public and just after the French Revolution, right? And it's amazing.
During the French Revolution.
It was during. So wasn't it one of the great declarations that this art is for the people? We cut the king's head off, and now what are you going to do with all this great art? Let's open it up and have a museum.
That's sort of it. I should say that the planning of the transformation of the palace into a museum had been talked about starting around 1750, which was during the Ancien Régime. Mm. So actually when in 1793, when everyone's head was getting cut off, the decision was made officially to open it as a museum. That was, in a sense, a continuation of what had been the stated policy of the Ancien Régime.
Ah.
It's interesting that when it was open in November 1793, it was not nearly as big as it would be a few years later, because a few years later, the armies of the revolution, especially under Napoleon Bonaparte, would ransack all the princely collections in Germany, in Holland, in Spain, in France itself, in Italy above all, especially in Rome, and all of those ill-gotten gains would be sent to the Louvre. So it was at that point, I mean, probably now the Louvre is the greatest collection in human history. It was probably, you could argue, twice as impressive in the 15 or so years during which Napoleon was in power, had gotten possession of all these extraordinary works of art and had not yet been compelled to give them back, which happened after the Battle of Waterloo in 1815.
Our guest on Travel with Rick Steves is James Gardner. He's a respected art and architecture critic from New York. He explores the Louvre inside and out in his book called The Louvre, The Many Lives of the World's Most Famous Museum. We have links to his work with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Hey, James, when we're going through the Louvre, of course, we're going to be looking at all the great paintings that hang on the wall, but it's really important to remember we're walking through what was a magnificent palace, and you could take the paintings out and still charge admission to the place, and it could be a good value. One of my favorite rooms is the Apollo, is it called the Apollo Gallery, where you've got the old crown jewels, and the room itself is just sumptuous. Give us just a sense of what we might look for in the Louvre beyond great paintings.
Well, first of all, you have a number of great period rooms. You mentioned quite properly the Gallery of Apollo, which has, as you say, the crown jewels of France. The form we see it in now, it was more or less conceived around 1661 after a fire in that room, but it wasn't really completed until the 1850s. And it's got, you know, paintings by Lebrun, it's got paintings by Delacroix, Clérisseau, a number of other excellent painters of the Ancien Régime.
And those paintings are actually not hanging on the wall, but they're part of...
They're on the ceiling.
So we can look at that great art by great painters designed into the ceilings and the walls of the building itself.
Exactly. That part of the Louvre has some of the finest period rooms that you'll find anywhere. You have right next to it the Room of the Seven Chimneys. You have on the other side the Salon Carré, which is an extremely important room in history because that was where every year you had the salon, the annual salon. Our word salon for a periodic art exhibition comes from that one room. Hmm. That was the center of all the attention of Paris, if not the entire artistic world, every August after 1737. So it's an important room in the history of art history. But the thing is that some of these rooms, like the Galerie d'Apollon, is in a perfect state of preservation. Others have been rather beaten up through a change, especially in the post-war years, where that kind of extraordinary, extravagant opulism ceased to be in fashion. Mm-hmm. So one of the finest rooms, the Salon Carré, which I just mentioned, it's hard to see how beautiful it once was.
Well, that's more reason than ever to go to a room like the Apollo Gallery and remember that's your chance to see the palace. One room I love, which everybody just walks right through, is right after the Mona Lisa.
That's right.
In that room, I don't believe it's got paintings hanging, but it's got paintings built in on the ceiling and the wall. I could just pull up a lounge chair and gaze at the ceiling for a long time and just be enthralled.
Well, good for you for noticing that painting. You're talking about, I think it's called the Galerie du Nom. I think that's the technical name of it. And it is indeed a beautiful room. It was created, the architecture and the painting, in the 1850s. But it's interesting in that it depicts the history of the Louvre, the series of events that turned it from a palace into a museum. Mm-hmm. So you have scenes of François Premier, you have Louis XIV, you have various steps along the path to its creation as a museum.
And Francis I was a very important character in assembling the collection, wasn't he?
That's right. It was he who acquired the Mona Lisa, for example, as well as a number of other paintings by Leonardo da Vinci, whom he invited to France in the first place.
Yeah. You know, the building's big, the museum's big, and the topic is big. We could talk forever. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with James Gardner. His book is The Louvre, The Many Lives of the World's Most Famous Museum. James, the big news in our generation is the Glass Pyramid. And, you know, controversial in its time, but it is just a reminder that the Louvre has been a work in progress. What's your take on this famous pyramid that created a new entry right in the middle of the courtyard the vast building surrounds?
Well, I am a great admirer of what I.M. Pei, the Chinese-American architect, created there. I think it's probably the single most impressive stroke of architectural genius in the past 50 years, not only because of its form, but because of its function and the combination of form and function with symbolism. It had to check three boxes, so to speak, and it did check all three in an exemplary fashion.
The three boxes would be, it looks good, it functions well, and it has symbolic meaning?
Yes, because oddly enough, it works because the Louvre is one of the centers of Egyptology, in one of the main centers of Egyptology in the world. It has possibly the best collection anywhere, and it's famous for that. One of the reasons it's famous for that is that Napoleon, you know, overran Egypt basically around 1801. And where you have the pyramid now is called the Cour Napoléon, Napoleon's court, named after him. So for a slew of reasons, everything comes together in the pyramid to create this symbolic resonance as well as a formal and functional resonance. I would just like to say that as fine as that structure is, it's really the roof, the covering of what's known as the Hall of Napoleon, which is down below grade. And there probably aren't that many people today who remember what it was like entering the Louvre before that was created. And it was a sort of dispiriting, unimpressive entryway. Now you have a really grand, beautiful entranceway.
You know, dispiriting is the good word for that. I remember well going into the museum in the old days, and it felt like you were sneaking into the back of a warehouse or something. And now you have this grand entry, and of those boxes we checked, I mean, that pyramid is certainly functional. I'm so thankful for the way the design of the welcome is. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with James Gardner, and his book is The Louvre, The Many Lives of the World's Most Famous Museum. James, I'd like to get just a couple of tips from you as a art critic and a historian who really knows the museum. The building is massive. It's got 36,000 works of art on display, and what I understand, 8 million visitors enter every year. What's your basic tip for the casual tourist that wants to enjoy the museum rather than being exhausted by it? What's your advice?
Well, assuming that this is your first time there, what I would suggest you do is undergo a process that I like to call filter feeding. Filter feeding, I understand, is what whales do at the bottom of the sea. They just open their mouths and float, and whatever comes in nourishes and sustains them. So rather than trying too hard to pay attention to each object, which will exhaust you, you should just walk through it and notice everything that you see and take it all in.
That is great advice, because I have done that accidentally with the Grand Gallery. That's a quarter mile long, I believe, the longest gallery of art anywhere. And I don't know the names of these painters. I don't care about any particular one. But I just walk through there, and now I know what I'm doing, filter feeding like a big whale.
You're filter feeding, yeah.
It's a cool idea.
Well, if you do that, you'll enjoy yourself rather than exhausting yourself. And then you should make a mental note to go back to see this, that, or the other thing.
James, just a last thought. What's the future of the building and the museum?
Well, I assume it will not only continue as we know it today, but it will be enhanced. And I actually heard that there's this courtyard, a very beautiful one, with this horseshoe-like configuration inside of it. No one can go there. Most people never even know it exists. You can sometimes see it out of the corner of one of the windows. They had been planning to open it in early 2020, but because of COVID, that didn't come to pass. So I would assume, I would hope that that's the next thing to open, and it will be most impressive if it does.
It's just great to know that the city values it. It's going to be continually a place to celebrate culture and to welcome people from around the world. James Gardner, thanks so much for giving us a better understanding of the Louvre as a building and an institution.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dans cette chambre sans la vue, impasse de la vertu. C'est rien qu'une histoire de cul, rien qu'une histoire vécue.
The Louvre has made its entire collection of nearly 500,000 works available online for examination up close. We have a link to that at ricksteves.com/radio. Next, we travel south for the sun and the beauty of the French Riviera on Travel with Rick Steves.